host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockey PDO Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me is my good buddy, Felix Sigard. Felix, what's going on, man?
It's going well, Dmitry. I'm glad to be here and talk about one of the most exciting teams in the NHL.
Yes, the Anaheim Ducks. We're doing the Anaheim Ducks deep dive officially. I mean, I've got a lot of negative thoughts that I probably that you're going to echo as well, and that we can unpack. I felt like it would be, you know, let's start with the glass half full approach and focus on what I think has been one of the real bright lights in this otherwise bleak, dark, cold environment that has been Anaheim Ducks hockey, dating back to last year, but especially picking up this year and sort of building on what he did last year. It's Troy Terry, who I think it was reasonable to be a bit surprised or taken aback. I think we point to Tage Thompson as someone who kind of just burst onto the scene last year out of nowhere after a couple of NHL seasons of relatively underwhelming production. And then, you know, he got that big contract and we're wondering how he's going to follow it up. And he's certainly proving that he's the real deal this season. We don't talk about Terry as much in that regard, but, you know, in his first three seasons in the NHL, he played 129 games. He had 15 goals, 48 points. And then he just breaks out last year. He scores 37 goals. He's got the 67 points. And so far this year, he's on pace for 34 goals, 86 points. All of the numbers have actually, in from what I've seen, improved. His performance has certainly looks like the real deal. So let's talk a little bit about Troy Terry and kind of what makes him special and how he's been able to have this sort of career glow up at the age of 24.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating topic because I know that you've had, you know, the likes of Daryl Belfry on your show, skills coaching. And I think really for him, he's always had that ability to carry the puck, you know, through the neutral zone. Like the tracking data always showed that from Corey Schneider. And he was able to, you know, work it off the half wall, work it down low. But the last season, you really saw him completely change his approach when he's entering that offensive zone, attacking the middle, attacking defenders, attacking their, you know, that triangle, their stick and their skates, and just looking for his shot so much more. And it's just like a fundamental shift in how he's approached the game. And if you listen to, you know, Terry and Akins and people around him talk, they talk about confidence and his confidence and mindset shifting. I'm sure he's more confident now that he scored 37 goals, but I think the confidence comes from, hey, I'm attacking constantly and creating chances for my team. So he always kind of had it in him, but now he's just taken it to a completely, you know, different level.
Yeah, I mean, clearly what sticks out to him is just how crafty he is, right? Like you see him, as you're mentioning, go kind of maneuvering through the neutral zone, the way he's able to make defenders uncomfortable by basically either utilizing that attacking triangle by either putting it under the stick or putting in their skates. You see it manifested in a number of different ways, right? One, last year he was amongst the league leaders in penalties drawn. And he's followed that up again this year. And I think that's proven to be a real skill. And two, and this is an interesting departure where last year I felt like he was really catching people off guard by sort of doing that old Ovechkin move, right? Where he comes down the wing and he uses a defender as a screen before ripping it through their legs and beating a goalie that way. And this year, I think he did it the one time recently against the Rangers where he kind of did it to Keandre Miller and he beat Jaro Halak with that move. But for the most part, he's been trying to do it and the puck hasn't been going in for him when he's been doing it. And I don't think it's for a lack of effort. Like, I think the executions has been fine. Not that the league has caught up to him by any means. I think that's kind of, you're going to have shooting percentage variance when you're dealing with shots from further out, but he's still found ways to produce offensively and create regardless. And so once those start going in for more for him as well, I actually think it's reasonable to expect that he's going to start producing even more goals this season than he has already so far.
Yeah. Like, I think that one of the big things last year, kind of working off that with his high shooting percentage, is that his on ice shooting percentage wasn't even really like that high. It wasn't that crazy. And he had 30 assists, which isn't much compared to those 37 goals. So this year he's still getting that production because that's gone up a bit and he's finding teammates. And yeah, to your point, his shot, he still hasn't really had like those crazy kind of like shooting streaks like he had last year. And they might not come. I mean, he's shooting 12%, but he's just looking as aggressive as ever. And I mean, I just think this is like the new normal for him. Like, he's going to be an elite kind of top line winger for years to come at this point. Like, there's no indication that this is ever going to stop.
It is. Yeah. I believe it's not updated because this was a few days ago, but Sportlogic had him as leading the league in rush chances about a week ago or so. And yeah, he hasn't really even converted on a lot of them yet. I think the way he has been able to produce, and what I wanted to talk about and what I think has really changed for him dating back to last year, is how much stronger he is on the puck. And I think in hindsight, it's really easy to do the hindsight game, right? Not that I saw this coming heading into last year by any means, but it would make sense in theory that a 24, 25 year old is kind of entering their physical prime and is getting stronger, and he's putting in the work in the offseason, and he shows up. And then all of a sudden you see now where he's not scoring on those shots coming down the wing anymore. But what he is doing is, instead of just being a one-dimensional kind of one trick pony where he's just waiting for it to happen, he's sort of trying to create in different ways and make his own luck. And so what he's done is he's basically taking the puck often from that kind of goal line area off the wall and just bull rushing it to the net and putting his shoulder down and taking it. And we saw him score a goal like that against the Seattle Kraken in their most recent game. He's produced a bunch both for himself and for his teammates that way. And that's something he didn't really have in his bag when he first came into the NHL. Like, you could see the puck skills in space, but whenever someone would come near him, it's like a gust of wind would blow and he would just go flying off the puck. And he's certainly gotten so much stronger in terms of being able to protect it and also actually take it into traffic. And so I think that is kind of been a development that makes you think that, okay, he's really kind of putting it all together and the skill is meeting the physical prime as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, to your point, you could always see that in his game, that he had that ability to control the puck, and he was always so good along the wall. And I think the difference now is that he's added that dimension off the rush, like you talked about with the Sport Logic data. And I think it really is, Joe, just a testament to the power of skills development, because a lot of this stuff, yeah, he's gotten stronger and he's talked about that. Dallas Eakins has talked about that, but I think it's just the way he's approaching the game, the skills that he's using, that he's worked on. This is stuff that he's developed over time. And it's not something that we really saw in his game. So it's been a joy to watch. And I am very curious now, because he is due for a new contract at the end of the season. And I'm very curious to see how exactly that will shake out, what that will look like.
Yeah, well, it certainly will. I've got some other stats for you. He's tied with Austin Matthews for 6 most high danger chances this season, which I think speaks to where he's taking the puck to the net. And, you know, we're going to talk about Dallas Eakins' job he's done. And I think I'm going to be, the tenor of it is going to be generally pretty critical, because I think the adjustments have not been there. One thing that I think this coaching staff, whether it's Eakins or whether it's whoever's running the power play, has done well is this recent change they made, where now they're all of a sudden, instead of having Terry on the flank, which makes sense, like he's got a good shot and you want to work that cross flank magic with him and Zegras, they've got him on the goal line where he's all of a sudden able to both kind of create as a facilitator, getting it out front for tap-ins in the slot, but also if the space is open and he's not getting that respect, take the puck to the net himself. And that's in turn, the trickle-down effect is it's created this beautiful passing window for Zegras to McTavish on the one-timer as well. And so for all the things that haven't worked and the fact that they just keep kind of just trying to jam a square peg into a round hole, this is one place where, in terms of their power play formation, you've actually seen it pay dividends in recent games.
Yeah, they've tinkered with it a lot. I mean, if you go back to the start of the season, they had Trevor Zegras on that right flank, and he scored a few goals off his one-timer. But I just don't really think Trevor Zegras's peak, I guess, look in the NHL on the power play is going to be as a one-timer threat. I think it's just more as a dual threat on his strong side. And you're seeing that now. He's on the left flank. He's always on his forehand, and he's able to make that cross size pass so much more easily. And yeah, they tried Troy Terry on that left flank, you know, across from Zegras, and Troy Terry's not really a one-timer threat either. He just doesn't really have that in his bag yet. Could add it. But yeah, that bumper spot is just so much more natural for him. And you know, they shift around quite a bit. And then Mason McTavish is just, I mean, he's showing a little bit of what we saw last year in junior as well from that right face-off circle.
Well, they've also embraced finally just having Terry and Zegras together at 5-on-5, right? Like, that was last year where, like, you'd see it in doses and you'd be like, all right, this is cool. Like, it makes sense that two very skilled players would riff off of each other. And then I believe they played, like, I've got it down as 203 5-on-5 minutes last year in their 68 games together. And this year in 22 games, they've already topped that total. And their offense, really a 5-on-5, is those two guys out there creating, because I think the rest of the team without them in three times as many minutes has created basically the same number of goals. And it makes sense from a talent perspective, but it's cool that, like, we're getting to see these two guys, at least when they're on the ice, at least like you have that to hold on to as a reason to watch and a reason to care about this team.
Yeah, I think it made sense to start the year to kind of try to spread the wealth. You know, they had Zegras with Vetrano and trying to really make that work, and it just didn't work. And I mean, this goes back even two seasons in the pandemic season, where and at the end of the year, you know, nothing left to play for. Aikens put Zegras with Terry, and you could already see that there was something there. And, you know, talked about it going into last season, saying, well, you know, defensively that might not necessarily be the look that they want, but it's just become undeniable. And especially this year, like you said, where the Ducks just get nothing going when those two aren't together, it's just, you got to get some kind of offense, and trying to spread the wealth it's just taking away from your team's ability to succeed at the end of the day.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we were able to talk about Terry here, because I've built my platform on talking Troy Terry up. When I put this podcast out, I'll do a mixtape on him as well, because he's been so cool to watch. So is there any other stuff on Terry, kind of his development over the past couple of years, or you want to tie that into Zegras as well, that we talk about in terms of like the positive stuff before we get into unpacking pretty much everything else?
Yeah, I think this may have popped up in some of your mixtapes that you've put out, but he's also, I think the thing with Terry is that he's just so good without the puck. Mm-hmm. He's so good at stripping the puck from defenders or guys carrying the puck, and that really feeds into his offensive game. He's always had that ability to suppress offense. He's so active without the puck, and yeah, he's just really a two-way monster. Like, I know that this is something you joke about a lot, but he might actually be the most underrated player in the league. Cause I think a lot of people know he's good, but they just don't quite grasp how good he really is.
I think that's fair. Cause I think if you polled most people, the majority answer would be Trevor Zegras as this team's best player. And I think maybe he could get there in terms of like, he's still younger, right? He's got more runway in terms of development, and the raw skills are so extraordinary that he could conceivably in 2 or 3 years, when he gets to this age, get there. But right now it's like, it's clear as day that Terry is the bus driver, and he's like their most valuable. And also they're just their pure best player at this point.
Yeah. I think honestly, Troy Terry is a first liner on just about any team. Like, it's not just a product of, oh, you know, he's on a bad team and he's getting all these opportunities. We've seen in Anaheim, guy like good players, you know, struggle, not look as good, and then go to other teams and magically kind of refine their game. And I think with Terry, he's doing it in this environment. So you could put him on any team in the league, and I think he would still look this good. And yeah, to your point, if you polled people, they would probably think of Trevor Zegras, and people still know that Troy Terry is good, but he's doing something special right now for sure.
Troy Terry is a very good. Okay, let's get to the bad stuff. So through 22 games, I'm going to give you like a stats dump here just for the listeners.
Oh boy.
I'm sure you're familiar with all this, but just for the listeners, so we're all on the same page. 6-15-1 record, one regulation win. Everyone else has at least four. The Devils are up to 15 regulation wins in the same number of games played already. I believe they were at zero until their 19th game of the season, so it happened fairly recently. Negative 37 goal differential. They're 30th in goals for. They're 31st in goals against. They've held a lead for 153 total minutes, which is about 11% of their game time. They've trailed for 47% of their game time or so. And I think the big thing that you keep coming back to here is defensively, because while the offense has not been scoring, the defense is catastrophically bad. I mean, they're averaging about 3.75 expected goals against per 60. Which would be the most porous team single season record that we've seen since 2007, since we have data access to. And you look at the heat map on Michael McCurdy's website of where they're conceding the highest volume of shots, and it's basically just one big red blob that's condensed in front of the net and then kind of like extends up towards the tops of the circles, which is basically the main area you want to prevent shots from. And that's where they concede the highest volume of shots in the league from. And I was watching their game last night against the Kraken, and then you and I were chatting in preparation for the show, and I kind of posed to you the question of, do we know what this team's current defensive zone coverage scheme they're running is? Because I was watching a few plays and I was like, okay, well, to my eye, it kind of looks like they're running a man-to-man, because it certainly doesn't seem like a zone. Like, it looks like everyone's kind of responsible for someone and they're moving around in that capacity. But then it's such a scattered mess at other times that the right answer is probably there is no plan. because it doesn't really seem like anyone is really on the same page. It's such a mess. And so I know like they're a rebuilding team. They've got young players. I think a lot of that gets excused, but the thing that I keep going back to is actually a lot of the players who are like the most egregious offenders here or culprits are actually veteran players who should be at least trained to not make these mistakes. And that's where you will get into, okay, how much of this is coaching? How much of this is environment? How much of this is talent? Because I'm sure it's some combination of the three, but I don't think we can just hand wave this as, oh, well, this is a bad team, because there's a difference between being bad and being like this bad defensively.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting conversation. And, you know, you look at like the projection models before the year, and it seems like a lot of people had this team kind of in that 80-point range, like low 80s, which is not a good team, but it's not this. It's not this just awful mess in the defensive zone. And
yeah, I think
a lot of it, like, you know, it might be harsh, but I think a lot of it is coaching, because this isn't really new from a Dallas Aikens coach team, a team that looks kind of disorganized in its defensive zone. I do think a lot of it, though, comes back to, you know, first off, like up front, you know, looking at the forwards, that you just have guys like Ryan Strome, for example. You talked about the veterans who, yeah, he's a veteran, you know, leader, and he's supposed to kind of be that responsible defensively. But looking back on his career, played a lot with Artemi Panarin, and it turns out that life away from Artemi Panarin is pretty difficult. So I think a lot of their defensive issues are just the fact that up front, their lines haven't really gelled and aren't able to really defend adequately. And that's just making life harder in the defensive zone. So it's just this crazy combination of things, but I do think that this roster, this collection of talent should be better than this, shouldn't be this catastrophically bad. And that does kind of like, that does lead back to coaching. It's hard to get away from it.
Yeah. I think on a recent podcast, I was talking with our pal, Thomas Drance, I believe. And I voiced like my disappointment in this team because I didn't think they'd be good, but I had hopes for like them being like a fun, frisky team that at least like, if you caught them on a run on the right night, similar to the Devils last year, where they were really bad defensively and they had these blow up games where they'd give up so many bad goals against that they lost more than they won. But if you caught them on the right night, you'd see the skill and you'd see like things coming together, and you could talk yourself into, okay, maybe in a year or two, if they make the right couple, pull the right couple strings here, all of a sudden it could really come together. And instead it's just regressed so much more in the opposite direction. And at the time I was like, they look so unprepared that it almost gives me the vibe of like a collection of guys who have like a 9-to-5 office job, and then they get together on a weeknight and just play a game and have some beers after, but they're not actually like practicing or, you know, discussing what they're going to do. It's really just like everyone going for a skate, getting some cardio in, having a good time. And I've changed my mind. It's not that. You know what it reminds me of? It's a cat with a laser pointer. Because you watch in the defensive zone, and it's like the puck is that moving red dot, right? It's everyone just immediately drops what they're doing. Like, it's like a defenseman is bodying someone in front of their own net and trying to clear the crease. And then all of a sudden they see the puck out of the corner of their eye, and they just leave their guy to go try to play that. And in the most recent game against Seattle, you saw a number of times where with these very simple offensive motions, the Kraken were running, where they would basically just cycle it from one side, move it to the other and get it around the net. And then all of a sudden the defenseman would just leave his spot in front to go to try to play the puck. And then it would just leave this exposed area in front where the Kraken could basically step into whatever glorious scoring chance they wanted. I mean, that goal Vince Dunn scored was like inexcusable at the NHL level. I don't care who your personnel is. You could call up a list of a group of AHL players, and they should not be giving up that type of a look where it's basically at 5-on-5 off of a regular sequence, a clean runway for the other team's defenseman to basically skate into a great shot. Like, that just can't happen. And I don't know how much of that is coaching, but it keeps happening. So the fact that they're not making adjustments makes me think that they're at least partly to blame.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's funny because today Pat Verbeek they have a podcast where he comes on, like the team does a podcast, and he kind of talks.
Has a podcast?
Well, it's called The Beaker, actually. Oh, nice. Okay. Not a sponsor or whatever, but they do a podcast. And it was interesting because he kind of touched on that a little bit, where he said that you have guys out there who look like they don't trust the next guy to do his job. So you're trying to do that guy's job, and then you end up not doing your own job. And that sounds like a man-to-man kind of issue. And it's interesting that you bring that up, but I do think, yes, you know, the blue line looks catastrophic, and it is, a lot of that is on coaching. But I do think part of it, like a part of it is personnel defensively, because John Klingberg is not good defensively. Like if there's one thing we know about him, it's that he's not good. That's just not an area of strength for him, but he's made up for it in the past on the other end. And Dmitry Kulikov is fine, but he's just kind of a middle pairing guy. And
he's being asked to do too much. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And Cam Fowler, I think, is, you know, he's the best of the bunch here, but he kind of needs a solid guy next to him, or at least a solid-ish guy. And then Jamie Drysdale's been out, who, you know, we thought he might take a step this year. But really, to me, it's that third pairing, which you can say about a lot of teams probably. But like the fact that this team went out and got Nathan Beaulieu as one of the worst defensemen in the NHL over the last few years, like just a known bad commodity. The fact that he's out there playing real minutes, playing on the penalty kill, and then you have Kevin Shattenkirk, who looks like his best days might be behind him. Like that's something that's like an unforced error. They didn't have to go out and get Nathan Beaulieu, and now they're playing him, which, you know, that's at the coaching level. But there's a lot going on there that it's just made for that group to not really gel together.
Well, that's what makes it so much like less palatable or tougher to justify, right? If it's young players, if it's a rookie, or if it's like a player who's like 20 years old and they're just learning the ropes, and you just out of necessity throw them into the deep end, and you're like, all right, you're gonna develop here, you're gonna make a lot of mistakes, it's gonna be ugly some nights, but we'll deal with it, it's fine, we're not trying to win this year anyways, you can like talk yourself into that, okay, that's fine. But then when it's like Shattenkirk and Beaulieu, and even up front, right, like I think the most egregious defensive players they've had have been Ryan Strome and Frank Vatrano and Jacob Silverberg. And these are guys who have been around long enough, who are making like real dollars, who shouldn't be making these like very rudimentary mistakes where it's almost like it's like their first time playing in the league, even though they've been around for so long. And so that's what's almost frustrating, right? It's the veterans who are making the mistakes. So you can't really chalk this up as being, all right, well, this is part of rebuilding, other than the fact that I guess you know, these guys won't hopefully be around and playing for the Ducks in these roles by the time this team's good again. But it's not like there's reason to believe that these players who are in place are going to get better. It's almost going to have to be like a situation where you just cycle them out and bring new guys in who hopefully can do the job.
Yeah. I mean, Pat Verbeek said today on the Beaker that he saw this team as being at or near 500 at this point of the season, which to me sounds about right.
I thought so too, honestly. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's like a realistic expectation. And yeah, it is startling the fact that Ryan Strome in particular has just been so bad defensively, because that's a guy who they brought in specifically for that role. You know, Ryan Getzlaf retired, and Ryan Getzlaf, even in his final seasons, was solid defensively, like still good in that end. And Strome was kind of brought in to stabilize that a little bit. And yeah, just making crazy mistakes. And Frank Vatrano, again, like he's not really a guy that you should probably be depending on defensively. Like, I think it's probably time to break up the ex Rangers line at some point, but still, like the fact that they're playing this poorly, I don't think that these guys became bad players overnight either. Right. And so that's why I think there's a lot of blame to go around, especially on the coaching end.
All right, Felix. Well, I've got a lot of thoughts to piggyback off of that. But let's take a break here in the conversation. And then when we come back, we're going to keep talking about the Ducks and getting into all of it. You are listening to the Hockey PDOcast here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. All right, we're back here. More of the Hockey PDOcast. Dmitry Filipovich, my guest, Felix Sicard. Felix, we're talking about the coaching. We're talking about the expectations for this team. I think this is a good segue into, you know, you mentioned what Pat Verbeek was saying on what is it, the Beaker? This is the Beaker's getting a lot of shout outs on today's show. What he's saying about his expectations for the team in terms of the record. And I don't necessarily want to say that the results don't matter, right? Because it's a competitive sport. You're going to get judged on wins and losses. So it matters to some degree, no matter what your expectations are. But I think for this team, it's clear that, you know, if you can enter the season, you're rebuilding, you have some young players, you're playing the long game, you're not necessarily going to, you know, live or die with each loss or each result any given night. You want to see development, progression, kind of like good habits being built and a good playing environment or a successful one being steadily built upon, right? That's much more important to me than seeing whether they won or lost on a random Tuesday night or whatever. I guess for me, the trick here is that it becomes really difficult when a team is this bad. And we gave all those stats about how much they're losing, how often they're trailing, how bad defensively they are. The one complication is it becomes really difficult to properly evaluate players. And you hinted at this earlier, where we've seen players who all of a sudden their underlying numbers just completely plummeted on the Ducks, and they reach that age where it's like, all right, they're late 20s. Is this a physical thing? Are they just not what they used to be anymore? And then they go to a team. You see at Hampus Lindholm go to the Boston Bruins, and he all of a sudden becomes an elite shutdown two-way one-on-one defender again, right? Exactly what he was in his prime. That makes sense. I think that what was shocking to me was seeing Josh Manson go to Colorado, because the Avalanche clearly have a great team and a surplus of talent. But at that point of his career, I really didn't see the offensive involvement he showed in his game, especially in the postseason run, where he's like aggressively pinching in the offensive zone. He's jumping in into the rush and all of a sudden turning a 2-on-2 into a 3-on-2 and just playing this downhill style where you're like, where has this been? Like, this guy just looks like an entirely different player. And yeah, when you play with better players, you're going to wind up looking better. But I think that's the thing that they bump into here, where there's a few players there, right? There's Zegras, Terry, there's McTavish, where their talent is so good individually that we know what they are and they're going to shine through regardless. But then you have this whole swath of other guys who are kind of stuck in the middle. And if they can't distinguish themselves, it's almost impossible to know whether they're part of the solution for the future or whether they should be discarded or what you have in them. And that's a really tricky place as an organization, because you're kind of left just basically in the dark almost.
Right. It is very tricky. And I think that I don't know if there's really a right or wrong answer. You know, it's like a chicken or the egg situation where, yeah, of course, Hampus Lindholm goes to the Bruins, like one of the best ecosystems for a defenseman there can be, and looks better. But when you look that much better, and like you said, Josh Manson, the way he's looking in Colorado, it's not just that he's playing well, but it's the way in which he's doing it. I think you do have to ask yourself, why wasn't that coming out at all with the Ducks? Like, not even remotely so. And, you know, back to the Beaker here again, but they asked him about it today. They asked him what's going on with the coaching staff. And he said that, basically said, not making any changes for the foreseeable future or what have you. So it doesn't sound like that's going to change, but I do think you run into this issue where, what do you have in these guys? Like, I look at, for example, Isaac Lindstrom, who scored 16 goals last year, and you heard all about it, at least around the Ducks, about how well he looked and, you know, this burgeoning kind of shutdown player, what have you. And this year it's been a little hit or miss. And even last year, the underlying numbers weren't great. And you just want to see what these potential talents have in a better kind of environment. And I mean, I look at, like, to me, the shining example for this is what the Canadians have done this season, where, yeah, they're winning games and it's probably not good for the Bedard sweepstakes, but you can tell that they're finding out things about their young players. They're doing it in this kind of good environment, in a winning culture, what have you, even if the wins might not necessarily keep coming. And the Ducks it just doesn't feel like that's what's happening. And, you know, they've talked about how, oh, well, look at what Dallas Eakins did for Troy Terry and how he's allowed him to get that confidence. And that may be true. I think Dallas Eakins is a really good motivator, but Dallas Eakins was also the one scratching him a few years ago and not letting him play. So I don't know exactly how much the development happened there. And Trevor Zegras, I mean, last year and the year before, was getting benched left and right, you know, late game situations, not allowed to take faceoffs. So I just don't really know how much of a boost these guys are getting just at their baseline. And that's really tricky. Like you said, a lot of these guys are so good that it's probably not going to end up mattering, but you would like to see a better environment for that growth.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of Jeff Blashill in Detroit last year, where it's very clear that, and maybe, you know, Pat Verbeek coming from Detroit, it's like, all right, well, we're just going to play this string out. He's clearly not going to be here when we have intentions of at least competing, but it's not worth our time almost to make this move now. We're just going to play out the rest of the year. And that's obviously like a very tricky situation to navigate for everyone involved. Clearly, I don't necessarily feel bad for Dallas Eakins, because he's the sixth longest tenured coach in the league right now, which is a remarkable sentence to say out loud, and says as much about the NHL environment for coaches and how difficult it is to stick around as much as anything he's done. But it's the frustration for me is, you know, I mentioned how it's like the veterans who are kind of sometimes struggling here and not the young players. If you're going to be bad, that's one thing, that's totally fine. But I want to see some like experimentation and like, you know, trying to take risks and see what you have instead of just sort of the status quo, right? Like if you're going to lose, you may as well go down swinging anyways. And a lot of these times it's, you mentioned some of the tinkering here and there and some of the good adjustments they've done, but for the most part, it's been like a relatively unambitious experience. I want to say like, you think that's fair to say? Like, it's not like you wouldn't go down be like, wow, this team is really trying to change the game here. It's like, no, they're just losing. Like that's kind of what they're doing. I don't know. It's
well, like, yeah. I mean, you pointed out to me on Twitter last night, but yeah, Derek Grant is on the second line right now. And maybe that's a problem of a product of injuries, but yeah, if Derek Grant's on your second line, you're probably just not really trying to do stuff that much. I mean, to me, I think the example for all of this is the fact that Mason McTavish is driving a line right now comprised of himself, Max Jones, and Brett Leeson. And I'm going to be perfectly honest, I didn't know who Brett Leeson was before this season, and I feel like I pay a decent amount of attention to hockey, and they picked him up off the waiver wire, and that's actually been a good 5-on-5 line for them. Mason McTavish is able to drive a line, and for one period, I think it was last week, we saw Mason McTavish at center along with Ryan Strome and Frank Petrano, which is something that I've been kind of advocating for because it's clear that Ryan Strome and both Ryan Strome and Frank Petrano need a guy who's able to carry the puck up ice and create for them. So they actually tried it. They tried McTavish at center on the second line, and I thought, oh, wow, it's happening. And then it lasted one period. They got two shifts or three shifts, whatever, looked great. But because the Ducks were losing, they broke it up. And that's really the disappointment, is that there's still money on the table here that you could try to find stuff out about your team, and you're just not doing it. I mean, it's same thing with like Max Comtois, who's injured now, but clearly an offensive player. And for a lot of the season, he was kind of saddled in bottom six duties. So just doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
I can't believe you'd never heard of Brett Leeson.
Yeah, shame on me, I guess.
Well, Brett Leeson, I remember this very specifically because he was like an overager in the CHL, and he just like randomly exploded for a big year when he was like 20 years old. And it was a classic, like, maybe we shouldn't overreact to this because he's just like literally a grown man playing against children, basically. And the Capitals made him a second round pick. And I remember that very fondly. But yeah, I mean, it's telling because I was actually looking at the numbers and I couldn't believe. I was like, wow, McTavish playing with Strome and Petrano has been a disaster. And then it's been great playing with Max Jones and Brett Leeson. It's like, wow, that tells me a lot about everyone involved.
Right. So the thing is, to start the year, McTavish was on the wing with Strome and Petrano, and he's a center, and he's a guy who needs the puck on his stick. He's good at that. He's good at creating offense. He's a good play connector. And on the wing, he's just kind of stifled. And the one shot they gave him at center between those guys, it lasted all of one period. So, yeah, but shout out to Brett Leeson. I mean, he's on a good line right now. So
clearly
there's something going on there.
Well, the other thing that I posed to you in our chat was, I wonder what John Klingberg is thinking right now, because he signs that 1 year, $7 million deal this summer, right? It basically didn't have any better offers available. I assume the logic was like, all right, well, you know, I'm going to get a reasonable 1 year payday here, go to a situation where I'm going to be able to at least play a lot, especially in scoring situations, maybe get a good individual, you know, season in terms of production going, and then get traded whenever I want to, because he's got the trade built-in trade protection of, they essentially can't trade him without his permission until January 1st. And then after that, it's a 10 team deal. Right. And he comes into the year, and these are his totals so far. He's been outscored 23-11 at 5-on-5. High danger chances with him on the ice are 116-63 for the opposition. He's got the one goal and seven assists. Only four of those points have come at 5-on-5. And we mentioned Dmitry Kulikov, who has been his most regular partner so far this season. The two of them have a sub-30 expected goal share on the ice together. And so, you know, he's certainly not to blame by any means, because a lot of these issues we've been talking about are certainly things that have plagued John Klingberg for a lot of his career. But at the same time, I imagine when he was like mapping out how this year was going to go for him and how he was going to use it to get a bigger payday when the cap rose a little bit and other teams potentially had spending cash, it's about as badly as he could have misplayed a hand, I think. And he's not blameless, but also it's kind of like a bit out of his control as well, because I think we all expected this Ducks team to be at least a bit more competent than they've shown.
Yeah. And I think John Klingberg is definitely not a guy that you put onto a team that's still building out its infrastructure, just doesn't have a solid foundation, and just expect him to succeed. And that's where I go back to coaching. But really with him, it's just defensively, it's, I mean, you talked about the numbers, like sub 30 is just rarefied air.
Yeah.
It's hard to do. And it just seems like there's just no, he doesn't have that balance of knowing, you know, when to get involved offensively and where to be defensively. It's just been a bit of a mess. And yeah, like going into the season, the idea was he was going to be this, you know, power play staple, get his points there, play some solid minutes. And if the team was bad, at least, like you said, he's going to have some good individual numbers, be able to get flipped to a contender, and that's going to help him go get that contract. And hey, if it went well, then he maybe gets extended with the Ducks, or who knows, but that was always the plan. And this year, I mean, he's on pace for, I think, like less than 35 points, which is, you know, lower than his last few totals. So I just, it's not working out in pretty much any direction. I think there's still a chance that, you know, the Ducks could maybe get a little more competitive. They've shown that a bit lately, but it's just, I don't know. He just doesn't seem to fit whatever it is that they're trying to do.
Well, I don't blame them for it, because I think what they're trying to do very clearly is,
yes,
oh, this is a free asset for us. We're going to play him for 40-ish games and then get a pick of some, or maybe multiple picks for him. And I think that regardless of what his numbers are, just based on the name brand value, they still will be able to do so. Maybe not as much as they had ideally hoped for if it was a true home run signing, but still something.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, like, the signing is still a really good one. I mean, the Ducks had to hit the cap floor.
I
think we're like $18 million below the cap floor going to the offseason. And yeah, like, that's a good use of cap space. It's still a good move by Pat Verbeek. There's still, if he does eventually get traded, which it's looking pretty likely at this juncture,
they're still going to get something
for him. It's like free assets. So, and I feel the same way about the signings they made for Strome and Vetrano. Like, those are not deals that are going to be prohibitive. They're guys that even as they age, like, it's still going to be reasonable value for them. So it's just, I don't want to have that revisionist history, which a lot of people have had, which say, oh, this is a disastrous offseason, terrible team building. Like, no, this was always kind of like a year where they weren't quite yet going to be amazing or anything like that, but you would at least hope for some competitive movement.
Yeah, I think the Klingberg one is totally fine and the right move. I have no issue with the Vetrano one. I think the Strome one I push back a little bit on, just purely because of the term, right? Like, I just think there's no reason. And yeah, by 2025 or whatever, hopefully the cap will have gone up pretty significantly and it won't necessarily be a big deal. But it's kind of like almost like a needless risk from my perspective, because whatever value you'd glean from whatever Ryan Strome is at this point is not worth the even minuscule percent chance that $5 million that you have tied up in him in like 2025, 2026 can prevent you from doing something creative instead. You know what I mean? So there's always ways to get out of these deals. It's nitpicking, certainly, but that's one where I just didn't love it, because this team really shouldn't be giving anyone more than like 3 years at this point, other than the young stars.
No, that's completely fair. And that's definitely like the most objectionable deal that they signed. And I think that with him, I think it was just a matter of trying to fill this kind of role with Getzlaff leaving and whatnot. But yeah, to your point, like, that could just be Mason McTavish playing second line center, and then you can just fill out the rest
however you want. Like,
I think that would be much more interesting. And like $5 million, it's not as if you can't go get that
$5 million somewhere else
to get to the cap floor. So yeah, it's not looking like a great signing, but like we were talking about earlier, and it didn't look awesome at the time either. I think it was fair value for just what he is. Like, I think market value, that's like a fair deal for him. But to what we were talking about earlier, though,
like, it's hard to
say how good or bad he's truly been, because we're still not sure about this environment that these guys are playing in either. So it's just a very difficult kind of problem to solve right now for everybody involved.
Yeah. So how do you feel about that then? Do you feel like the objective for these final whatever 60 games they have on the schedule should be like at least trying to make a concerted effort to be able to better evaluate these players? Or do you think it's like, all right, we're going to be the worst team in the league and hopefully have the best odds of landing Connor Bedard, and that is worth it? Because I certainly see a lot of that from Ducks fans, and I get it. Like, if you have any, even if it increases 1%, like, you go for it, because that could legitimately make such a difference for your franchise moving forward. But I do think it might be underselling a little bit sort of this, like, how deep-rooted and insidious of a negative impact this situation can have for everyone, just because it's like, it's so tough to know what you got.
Yeah. And I think what's tricky with
this Ducks team is, yes,
they are rebuilding, but when Pat Verbeek was
brought on, he said that
this was not a team at like the ground floor. It was a team kind of in the middle of a
rebuild. And I
don't feel like they're kind of at that stage where you want to just be horrendous and tanking to, you know, to get, I mean,
of course, Connor Bedard
or whoever really in that top three or four would be great, but they're not really at that stage where it's like, these guys are so, so young that you can totally burn it down. Like, they have a lot of really good prospects already. And I think that they're not so far away from taking good steps. So for the final 60 games, I think that the goal, I mean, it doesn't sound like Dallas Eakins is going anywhere. I think the goal is just to maybe, you know, instead of playing some veterans or sticking with the same guys in depth roles, you know, call up a Jacob Perreault, call up a Braden Tracy, give Pavel Regenda more runway, and just let this kind of youth movement
really take hold,
because it's clear that like a Derek Grant, or I mean, even a Max Jones, who's 24, but like we kind of know what he is at this point. Brett Leeson, even, like, let's just kind of see this next wave and give them more of a shot. I think that would probably be the best use of these last 60 games. And hey, that might even make the team better. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love the way they handled last deadline, right? Like, I know it's tough to see all these guys that we just mentioned, like Lindholm and Manson, go on and thrive and look great in other situations, but what they came away from it with a 2022 first, 2022 second, two 2023 seconds, a 2023 third, and a 2024 second, and then a couple prospects as well. And now you look ahead, and I think part of the logic of a lot of what they did was, well, you got Klingberg, you got Shattenkirk, you got Kulikov, who they got for nothing. You got Grant, who now is in a starring second line role and hopefully is a little bit of a feature opportunity for him. Even Anthony Stolarz is like a backup goalie. I assume pretty much everyone here is going to be available for whatever draft capital they can recoup. And they also are fortunate to have three salary retentions available to them because they haven't tied up any of them moving forward. So they can facilitate a lot of deals in a very tricky financial environment where teams are going to desperately be willing to pay extra for anyone that can fit under their cap. And so they're going to be a pretty good spot in terms of doing similar. They don't have necessarily the big names that they had last summer in terms of impending UFAs, but I assume that's going to be sort of the motivation again here at the deadline. And in a way, you're right. I think that could almost be like a positive on two fronts, because one, they get the draft capital, and two, they might actually be more fun to watch and better after they make some of these deals.
Right, exactly. And I think going back to last deadline, I think there's a lot of people right now who are thinking, well, you know, Josh Manson and Hampus Lindholm would look pretty good on this team right now, would really
round out this blue line. And I really
just think that even if you can say that maybe Lindholm and Manson were better than they showed, for a team that is still rebuilding, even if it's maybe in the later stages, you don't sign these kind of, you know, older 20-somethings to an 8-year deal or what have you. Like, those just weren't smart decisions
that for Pat Verbeek to make.
So I think that those decisions still hold up. And yeah, like you said, they got a pretty good haul for them.
And going into this deadline,
there's still a lot of fat to trim on this roster. Like, you can still, I think as bad as Kevin Shattenkirk has looked for a lot of his Anaheim tenure, there's probably still a team out there that's saying, oh, Kevin Shattenkirk,
he was good with
New York, right? You know, we can go get him. Same thing with John Klingberg, still a name. We'll see what they do with Anthony Stolarz, because I think he's been really good as a backup.
But there's still a lot of
wiggle room here. The Ducks can still come out of the season. Like, this season can still be a win. They can
still
amass a lot at the deadline. They can still find out what they have in some of these players. And like, it looks rough right now. It looks about as rough as it ever has, but this team is still very well positioned moving forward with their prospects,
with their cap space,
with the guys that they have on their roster, the younger players. It's like, this is still a team that I think will be competing, like, probably within the next couple of years. It's not going to take that long, I don't think.
No, I commend him. I guess, like, you know, he had the benefit of coming in with a relatively clean slate and like not being emotionally attached at all. And so he could kind of pull the trigger on a lot of these moves. But I think people forget that around this time last year, like, what was the Ducks record? Like, they were the team that I thought they might be again this year, where they come out, they like capture your attention a little bit. You're at least excited about what's happening. They're winning more games than you probably expected. And there was a big question of, what are they going to do with all these players? And I think there's no doubt that it was the right long-term move. Forget even the extensions, just to get as many assets as they could for all these guys. And not to mention, like, what have we been talking about this entire time? I saw what Josh Manson and Hampus Lindholm looked on this team, and it was not what they are right now. And so there's no reason to believe that they would have replicated that form this season. I think it would have been a lot more of the same, and we'd be like, oh man, they really should have gotten out from these guys because they're way past their prime, when in reality, it's probably just because it was a really tough situation to play in.
Right, absolutely. I mean, Pavrobeek really hammered home that he didn't want to take on these big term contracts, which you could say, well, what's going on with that Ryan Strome deal? But yeah, for Hampus Lindholm, I mean, he was wanting that 8-year deal from the Ducks, and I think Josh Manson, he got a solid deal from the Avs. Those just weren't smart contracts for this team to sign. Now, it's definitely not a guarantee that if Bob Murray had still been the GM, that those guys would have been traded, because as obvious as moves as I think those were, Bob Murray showed a pretty strong willingness to re-sign veterans that are not in their prime anymore. I mean, look at the Silverberg and Henrique deals that are still on this team's books. Like, those are just not deals that are going to help this team. Adam Henrique has actually had a bit of a resurgence.
Yep.
Yeah, he's been great. But you know,
wow. Yeah, let's pump the brakes on great. I think he's been good. He's there. I mean, listen, they would have given him away for anything last year, to take the contract off their hands last year. Now he might actually become an asset heading into next season.
Yeah, I should probably pump the brakes there. But you know, when this is the only team you watch, you kind of like
you've got Anaheim Ducks brain. You're like, oh, yeah, he's great compared to everything else.
Your sense of what a good player is kind of distorted. But his underlying numbers were solid last year, though. I don't know about this year as much, but with Silverberg, I mean, it's kind of hard to watch because he was such a solid player in his prime, and now he had a blood clot issue last year, and it's just. Yeah, that's the risk you take when you sign these deals. So I think for Pavrobeek, it was absolutely the right move to trade those guys. And I thought that they were going to be able to fill up that hole a bit better with Klingberg and Kulikov. Like, on paper, it looked like it was feasible. Hasn't happened, but that's okay. Like, these are just no risk moves at the end of the day.
Well, and let's end on a positive note. I think this upcoming summer is a really big one for this organization, right? Because they've got Troy Terry up for a new deal. Trevor Zegras up for a new deal. JB Drysdale up for a new deal. They enter the draft they have 6 picks right now in the top 100. I assume they're going to probably add at least a couple more if they're second or third rounders or whatever for some of those players we listed. So they're going to go into the draft armed. We'll see what their first round pick might be. It might be first overall based on the way they're trending. And I think that it's easy to talk yourself into being back in on this group, depending on how they handle this summer. And I think I'm going to be there, because as disappointed as I've been so far, I just can't quit this team for some reason. Give me the case for why I should be optimistic about what they're going to do this summer.
Well, I think that the case for optimism is one guy that we've talked about a lot already, which is Troy Terry. I think that I don't know exactly what his next contract is going to look like. You know, Evolving Hockey isn't projected at 4 years by $5.5 million. That seems like a bargain. So I don't know. But the case for this team is that almost no matter what they do, they have guys on their roster who are going to be either as good or going to take big steps. Like, I think we haven't seen the best yet of Trevor Zegras. We have not certainly seen the best yet of Mason McTavish. Olin Zellweger is going to be on this team at some point. So just that alone is already going to lift this team up. And then, you know, from there, I think that there's just going to be so much flexibility to kind of tinker with the bottom six. I think that, you know, Derek Grant may be gone. Who knows? Like, there's going to be some shuffling around in that bottom six, which has been an issue for this team. And maybe I hate to keep bagging on the guy, but maybe having a new coach will also help a lot. Like, I don't really see how Dallas Eakins justifiably comes back next season. So whatever they do, if maybe it'll be an Andrew Brunette, who knows, that's going to help this team out a lot as well. So I'm still here. I'm still going to beat the drum. It's getting pretty lonely. I mean, it seems like you're still on the island, but I still think that there's a very bright future for this team.
Yeah, I'm on the island for hate watching them the rest of this season, but being excited about the outlook moving forward, because you're right, like Zegras and Terry and some of the young blue liners, you can talk yourself into it. I think it'll be a big summer. I think there's reason for optimism. It's cute that you think that Derek Grant will be gone. Derek Grant will never be out of your life. He will always be on the second line, sometimes the first line for the rest of our lives on this Ducks team. So rest assured with that. But yeah, no, I'm a, listen, like I, when we did our watchability rankings at the start of the season, I like on my first draft, I had them as like fourth or something. And then I eventually like Cam Schron and Thomas Trans talked me off the ledge a little bit and bumped me down to like, I don't know where I had them. I think like eighth or 10th or something. And which was still in hindsight, way too high, but that's how excited I was about this group from a watchability perspective. And I've been sorely disappointed. So honestly, this chat was as much for me as the listeners, because I needed like a 50 minute therapy session with you to just kind of talk my feelings through this.
Well, I'm glad I can help. It's been really rough. I mean, they're still watchable if you're a fan of the other team. Like, you could still get something out of whatever the other team's got going on. I just love that last night against Seattle that Daniel Sprong did the like ear to the hand to the ear to the crowd thing.
Yeah.
Because like I Kirby docked it. I'm just not convinced that many people in the crowd actually even knew that Daniel Sprong ever played for the Ducks. But
yeah, anyway. the 47 people still in their seats at that time were kind of like indifferent on it.
Big, big revenge move by Daniel Sprong. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was really funny because it was like, he didn't even make a move, but Kevin Shattenkirk just went absolutely barreling into his own goalie and knocked him out of the play. And yeah, it was like, it was an empty netter, really. Certainly, but yeah, you know, it is what it is. Daniel Sprong certainly is not short on confidence and swagger. And so I'll give him that much. All right, man. Well, this was a blast. I'm glad we finally got to do this. I'm a big fan of your podcast. So I'll let you plug it here. And you better not shout out the Beaker anymore, because both myself and the listeners can't take any more Beaker shout outs, but I will let you plug your own podcast.
Yeah. If you want to check out the podcast I do with my good buddy, Jake Rudolph, it's Crash the Pond, where we have a podcast up every week. We're also writing now at the Sporting Tribune, covering the Anaheim Ducks there. So just check me out on Twitter, Felix Sicard, search for me. And yeah, if you need your Ducks fix and Derek Grant complaints, we've got you covered.
I want to give a shout out to your pal Jake and my pal as well. One of the nicest guys in the industry. So I wanted to make sure
he
loved in the show. Yeah. Love Jake. All right, man. Well, this is a blast. I'm really glad we got to do this. Certainly have you back on. I think maybe we should aim again for closer. Actually, we'll see at the deadline if this team gets involved in some of these trades, but certainly as we get into the offseason, because I think there are going to be some fireworks coming out of the Ducks.
Yeah. Can't wait.
All right. Cheers, pal. You are listening to the Hockey PDOcast, streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.